Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
This is an auspicious event. We're really pleased to have everyone here, friends and family, to really launch this magnificent idea that Alex Kalesi, the chair of the Department of Neurosurgery at UC San Diego, and Frank Fornari he's a scientist here par excellence who's worked on brain tumors for a large part of his career. We'll talk about how we combine forces through the Sanford Stem Cell Institute and use this incredible venue to have a meeting of the minds. So we call it Medicine Informing Novel Discoveries, but I really wanted to bring Catherine Canjo up just for a short minute because Sheldon Morris, who's on the board here for the Museum of Contemporary Art, keeps saying we have one of the best museums of contemporary art in the world right here in our backyard. So let's use these events to bring people from disparate backgrounds together to really try and solve these very difficult problems to humanity. So, Catherine, did you want to come up and just say what the upcoming events will be at the museum?
Kat, thank you so much, and wonderful to see you all here. This has indeed been an inspiring series, and I appreciate Kat letting me talk just for a second on this night in particular. I wanted to let you all know that we have an important exhibition forthcoming here at the museum. It's an exhibition that's called For Dear Life. For Dear Life, Art, Medicine, and Disability. And this is an exhibition that's gonna open in the fall and run through February. And it's really a groundbreaking show because it's bringing together works that artists have created since the 1960s dealing with For Dear Life, dealing with the body and the body politics. These are artists that have, you know, come of age in a period of movements, of protests and calls to action, if you think of the 60s with the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, all of these things coalescing. So we're looking at, historically, how artists have dealt with this subject matter. Because many people think artists are only now, in this sort of post-COVID moment, dealing with this topic. But in fact, it's been an abiding interest to artists in our own time. So we will show that. But really, I wanted to mention it tonight is because the title, For Dear Life, it's this kind of plaintive thing, right? It's tender and tenacious. I mean, you hold on. So we have this poetic title, For Dear Life. The subtitle does a little bit more business, Art, Medicine, and Disability. It's kind of dispassionate in a way. And it's like, usually the subtitle, the subtitle is a very particular sentiment, which comes to us from one of the artists who's featured in the exhibition, whose name is Catherine Sherwood, who is an artist practicing since the 1970s, but who received increased attention after she suffered a cerebral hemorrhage that paralyzed part of her body, and she had half of her body, and she had to relearn how to move and to paint. And so she painted with her left hand. And previously she had been right-handed. And the media, you know, celebrated these abstract works as saying that somehow, you know, something new in her was unleashed and made this distinction in her mind of her being a disabled artist. And she doesn't want to be seen as disabled. She's looking to call to the continuum of the connections between her art making and medicine and disability. So while some folks, you know, try to remove the medicine and from ability or disability, she's like, no, there's a continuum. And she becomes an artist who continues to achieve artistic success and who's really launched the disability art, medicine, and disability movement at UC Berkeley, where she teaches a class used to teach that class until her retirement. That's a long way of saying we hold an exquisite painting by Catherine Sherwood, many paintings in our collection, but an exquisite piece that will be featured in the exhibition. And I'm hoping that the artworks can speak to our shared audiences here. And part of the reason why we chose this as a subject matter is not just that artists are working in the topic, but that we here in this San Diego region are, you know, a center for biomedical research and innovation. So we are looking forward to having that further connection between your world and ours.
Well, We have a combined world. And thank you so much, Catherine Canjo, for introducing this. So the whole point is the art of science and medicine, and there are various instigators in the audience, particularly Erwin Jacobs, who has insisted that we all work together through the Institute of Engineering and Medicine. But the idea that really massive discoveries, impactful, paradigm-shifting, practice-changing discoveries happen at the interface between fields started with you, Erwin, and really made us think, well, maybe we should think collectively about these problems. Now, as the director of the Sanford Stem Cell Institute, it's really a privilege to introduce the Brain Tumor Program here as a special mind event, Stem Cells in the Human Brain. But just to remind us of how important this topic is, our friend Bill here is in the audience. He's been a real champion for patients who find themselves in this unfortunate position of having a brain tumor. In these pictures, there's somebody there that has a brain tumor that doesn't know they have it. And this was on a ski trip to Mammoth. We were skiing blue runs. The one person wanted to ski all blacks. And then we tried to find the oldest tree in the world, the bristlecone pine. Didn't find it, but that was an incredible trip 3 weeks before this person was diagnosed. The person was Barbara Hagee, an incredible collaborator, instigator for doing things that are right for humanity, even when no one else is looking. So if we do that together, if we take Barbara's strong view, she was a computer software engineer, great mom, great friend. Bill, you can comment a little bit later in the day, but the idea is this is about all of us. These are about the events you can never predict. So let's have a solution for all of us, and let's start working today. No pressure, Alex. Or Frank, I know you're there, and you'll be joining us. But I wanted to preface this by saying that what we're doing with these mind events is trying to get people kind of out of their comfort zone. Where are we all not exactly comfortable, whether we're scientists we're used to being in the lab, or we're administrators of big funding organizations like CureBound? You know, we've got to think about how we do this together because we have a very strong sense of urgency. And I always use this quote from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, when time lets slip a little perfect hour, oh, take it, for it will not come again. This is our little perfect hour. And we will talk about a little bit about the Sanford Stem Cell Institute. We formed last year, March, thanks to T. Denny Sanford, giving us a very large gift to make sure that we get our discoveries from the bench to the bedside, but also understand when are things not working in the clinic? When should we be partnering with new people to really understand why and in whom these therapies work? So Sheldon Morris is the director of the Sanford Stem Cell Clinical Center with Deputy Director Sandy Patel. We have the great opportunity to work with Sylvia Evans as the director of our Discovery Center, and Rob Signer, you'll remember the last one we had, Stem Cells and Human Longevity, was highly attended as well. That was our second in a mind event. And there's Danny, always keeping us on track. Thanks, Michelle, for always being here as well. Michelle's always quiet. But you see, we have some interesting people showing up. We have an advanced therapy center run by Dan Kaufman and Karen Christman, and then two space-related centers, iScore, that Alison Motry and I co-direct. And then Stem Cell Fitness and Space Medicine, we have Tatiana Kisileva as our director, working always with David Brenner, thank you for being here, and then Ludmil Alexandrov, who just became a full professor on Friday, so we're very proud of Ludmil. And then Jean Yeo and Alexis Comer running the Innovation Center so they can make all the diagnostics that you ever cared to think about, but also Alexis Comer co-founded Beam Therapeutics, so she can fix those point mutations. So we said, well, we've got six centers. Aren't we done? No. Alex and I started plotting. Brain tumors are too important. And Alex will tell us why, and so will Frank Fernari. So we thought, this is a unique opportunity to start a program, but hopefully grow it into a center with your help. This is a uniquely challenging issue. And we want to get over the challenges for patients so that they don't have to go through this. So this is our official launch of the Brain Tumor Program. I wanted to say a little bit about the work that we've been doing on how cancers evolve from precancer stem cells and how they evade the immune system. This is a shout out to Teresa Esposito here. You might want to wave. She's been working on this together with Jessica Pham, who's at the back. So what we've discovered is that ADAR is a gene that drives metastasis. And you can see from Teresa's work here that when the cells decide to invade and metastasize, they turn on this reporter gene that has luciferase. And then we can see these other genes like beta-catenin and an immune evading gene going up. So why does this matter? Why are we talking about this today? Because Naj, Kafori Beaumont, and Alex Kalesi have provided the sample so we can study this in real time for women with metastatic breast cancer to the brain. And then people with GBM, do they respond the same way? So these are all opportunities to make new therapeutics. Here's a drug that we're making that targets ADAR specifically. And this is Jessica. I always have to show Jessica because she decided to test this drug in space. So this is our friend Walter Villadey. So he's an Axiom 3 astronaut. This is thanks to Janice Studemeyer helping us with these always middle-of-the-night experiments where we're trying to showcase that the brain tumor organoids grow faster in space. So Walter Villadey is putting these on the Keyence microscope on the International Space Station. So it's a uniquely accelerating environment to understand how cancers evolve. NASA seems to quite like this approach and have decided to fund a rather large grant that we have and in partnership with Axiom and UC San Diego, the Sanford Stem Cell Institute. So we see the brain tumor organoids, they're from breast cancer. Here they respond a little bit to this drug fedratinib that we co-developed, and now rubexinib is really shrinking them. So I'm bringing this up because we're developing therapies in real time. There will be no downtime. As long as you give us an opportunity to all work together, we'll get it done. Just tell us how quickly, and we'll get it done. So that got into Fortune magazine. Those were real data, because it is a bit frustrating for all of us to work in our silos. But, you know, with events like this, maybe we'll get beyond the silos. Inga van der Werf is here to make sure that we have a really robust biorepository so we can get these samples to patients. So it's really a privilege to introduce Frank Frenari and Alex Kalesi as leaders in the field of brain tumor biology, but also neurorestoration. So as we build from a program to a center, we really want to include neurorestoration because of what Catherine brought up. It doesn't have to be disability. We can transform from disability to ability. I don't believe in a new normal. I think there's only normal. I think we need to get back to the regenerative capacity of the human brain and the body. And we'll talk with Anne as a patient advocate, but also somebody who's very involved in corporate partnerships, an absolute powerhouse of making sure that we work with the right partners. So first I'd like to introduce Frank Frenari, who will be joining us virtually today. This is meant to be like an amuse-bouche when you go to a very nice restaurant. So Frank is going to introduce, and then the whole idea of the brain tumor program, and then Alex will follow up. We will have a closer look seminar series on this topic. It's usually about a month after we have this MIND event. So this is just meant to tantalize. It's the appetizer. The next one will be the full meal deal, right, Alex? So Frank Frenari, professor in the Division of Regenerative Medicine, and then he co-directs the brain tumor program. Take it away, Frank. Thank you.
Thank you, Kat. I'm very sorry not to be there this evening. Apparently, I was traveling this past week in Ireland and came back with a bit of COVID in addition to a bit of the blarney. So please forgive me for not being there. So if you have any questions about my presentation tonight or the lab's research during the social time following the talks, please see my student, Brett Taylor. He's a very talented MD-PhD student. He should be there in the audience, and he'd be very happy to chat with you about anything that I might discuss. So you're probably wondering what this is on the first slide. This is one of our human brain tumor models growing in the brain of a mouse. And this was developed in my lab from genetic engineering of human stem cells. This model is a replica, or as we like to call them, avatar, of the highly aggressive brain tumor glioblastoma. So what is glioblastoma? This accounts for about 50% or greater of adult primary brain tumors. It's very aggressive. There's about 13,000 cases per year of GBM in the U.S. Now, you might say, well, that's a very small number, But if you take into consideration the entire globe, there's about 300,000 cases of GBM per year. So this is a significant problem. It has a five-year survival of less than 10%, and it's believed to arise from glial cells. These are the cells that hold our brain together like glue. The word glia means glue. And in terms of risk factors, we don't know too much about risk factors other than males have a slightly higher incidence of GBM than females, Caucasians slightly higher than other populations as well. So the prognosis, as I've alluded to, is very poor. And this is even with the advent of the introduction of temozolomide. This is a DNA damaging agent. This was added to the standard of care therapy of surgery plus radiation in 2005. And this increased survival by a mere 2 months. So the overall survival with the addition of temozolomide is 15.6 months. Subsequently, there's been the introduction of tumor treating fields. This is a helmet that is worn by brain tumor patients that emits an electrical field to the brain that disrupts the division of the tumor cells. And this has increased survival, overall survival, to about 20 and a half. So the question is, why are these cancers so difficult to treat? And I think there's at least five reasons for this. These tumors have limited response to traditional and targeted therapy, as I showed you on the previous slide. They're highly invasive. I think you can appreciate that from this section of a brain where it has a tumor mass in this hemisphere, as well as a secondary mass here on the other side of the brain. So the cells have crossed the corpus callosum. They're immunosuppressed, meaning that our immune systems do not recognize these tumors, so we call them cold tumors. There's no early detection like we typically have for breast cancer, colon cancer, or even prostate cancer. There are really, as far as I know, no tests to detect a brain cancer early. But above all these tumors tend to be extremely heterogeneous. And what do I mean by heterogeneity? Well, there's two types of heterogeneity. There's intertumoral heterogeneity, that is the difference of cancers between patients. And there's intratumoral heterogeneity, which refers to the fact that a single tumor is made up of different types of cancer cells. These cells can vary in many ways, such as their appearance, their genetic makeup, and their behavior, how fast they grow, how they respond to treatment, etc. This diversity within the tumor make it a challenge to treat because some parts of the tumor might respond to particular treatments while others might not. In simple terms, it's like having a garden with many different kinds of weeds. Each weed needs a different therapy or a different approach to get rid of. So if we consider this cancer evolutionary tree, we can see here that the earliest mutation, I'll call it A, occurs in the trunk, followed by mutation B in these branches, which are colored blue, followed by mutation C in these red branches, and then lastly by mutation D, this yellow region here, rather a private area of the tumor. And so if we treat with a drug that can eliminate cells which have mutation D, you will note that part of the tumor is still present. And likewise, if we treat with a drug that is specific for mutation C, we still have residual tumor. And so we really need to think about what are the earliest mutations in these cancers. And the earliest mutation that I'm aware of from numerous studies is the TERT gene, which stands for telomerase reverse transcriptase. This is an elegant study that just came out this year from UCSF, and it shows the tumor that was sampled in 10 different regions, and each one of those regions had mutations in this gene within the promoter of the TERT gene, where there were other regions within this tumor that had private mutations as shown here. So TERT mutations seem to be the earliest mutations occurring in GBM. And why is TERT important? So as I mentioned, TERT is telomerase reverse transcriptase. This is responsible for maintaining the ends of our chromosomes As probably many people in the audience know, as we age, our chromosome ends, the telomeres, that is, become shorter and shorter to the point at which our cells will senesce or stop dividing. This is a normal aging process. Now, cancer cells figure out ways to get around this. They figure out a way to reactivate telomerase expression, which is normally turned off in aging cells. And GBM does this by a very specific mechanism, and that is to mutate the promoter region of the TERT gene. So this causes activation of TERT expression. Now, GBM has mutations in the TERT promoter. 85% of them have mutations. This is the most frequent mutation occurring in GBM. But you'll note that other cancer types to the right have mutations in TERT promoter as well. So what we learn about the TERT promoter and its mutation could very well be applied to other cancer types. So with this in mind, the hypothesis that my lab has is that since TERT promoter activating mutations are early events in glioblastoma formation that lead to tumor cell immortality, we should develop drugs tailored at blocking the activity of this mutation. To do this, my lab teamed up with Gene Yeo and his colleagues to develop a new system of brain tumor models, which we call brain tumor adaptops. And the way this works is we take human stem cells, engineer them with different mutations which are typical in GBM, using CRISPR-Cas9 editing. And many of you probably are aware that CRISPR-Cas9 was the subject of a Nobel Prize a couple of years ago. So we use this technique to introduce mutations into stem cells. We then use small molecules to differentiate these cells into a progenitor cell, which is a what we think is a cell of origin of GBM. We inject these into the brains of mice, and then within 3 to 5 months, these mice develop tumors in their brains. And then we take the tumors out and we analyze them and we make sure that they are identical to brain tumors by a variety of characteristics. And every model we've made to date is a perfect replica of a human tumor. So with this model system, which I call phase one, we're now in the process of looking for therapeutic targets in the variety of avatars that we've made. So we call this phase two. So as proof of concept, we made the TERP promoting mutation in one of our particular avatars, and we grew these cells in culture, either short-term or long-term, as shown here. And you can see that the long-term cells continue to grow in this petri dish in our incubator. So this illustrates that the TERP promoter mutation conveys cell immortality. However, if we don't have that mutation, so these are what we call the wild type or the control cells, you see that the cells are no longer dividing or they're slowing down in their cell division. So they're illustrating cell senescence. So this is a perfect example that the TERP promoter mutation is absolutely essential to convey cell immortality to GBM cells. So with this in mind, we did a synthetic lethality screen. This is a scientific method that's used to find points in cancer cells that can be targeted with treatments. In other words, looking for the Achilles heel of the cancer cell based on a particular mutation. And what Gene and I were able to show is that there's about 40 genes from this particular experiment that are absolutely essential for the growth of tumors with TERP promoter mutation. In other words, they are not needed for those tumors which have no TERP promoter mutation. So we now have in hand what I would call 40 shots on goal to try to develop therapeutics targeting one of these genes. So I'm going to end on this slide and just bring to everyone's attention, we've developed a rather extensive avatar catalog of different molecular subtypes of GBM, adult tumors, as well as pediatric tumors, such as atypical teratoid rhabdoid tumor as diffuse infiltrative intrinsic pontine glioma. And my last few thoughts are relevant to the Sanford Stem Cell Institute's brain tumor program, as Kat introduced you all to. You know, over the years, I've reviewed many brain tumor programs around the country, UCSF, MD Anderson, Dana-Farber. And while each one of these programs has strengths and various strengths, such as Dana-Farber is very good at sequencing and vaccine development, UCSF is great at novel imaging modalities and use of modified T cells to target tumors, I do think that UCSD is very well positioned with its own unique abilities to approach the problem of brain cancer. We have cutting-edge research. In addition, we have the Center for Novel Therapeutics that can engage with Jacobs School of Engineering and the Stem Cell Institute. We have annotated patient tissue collection and distribution from Moores Cancer Center. And we also have, quite frankly, the biggest industry engagement in the country. So we have a biotech hub here, which is second to none. And none of this is possible without a world-class neurosurgery and neuro-oncology program headed by Alice Khaleesi, my colleague, who I will now hand it off to present his talk. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Frank. So you see, we've got the best and the brightest here, and a real star that I've had so many opportunities to work with, but not in such a concerted effort. So this is a thrill, Alex. Thank you so much for being here. Dr. Khaleesi is the youngest neurosurgeon to have ever taken on a department in the U.S., is running the Neurosurgical Society in the U.S. right now. So we'll let Alex take it away. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, good evening, Kat. Thank you for that introduction. And Frank, thank you for that outstanding talk. As Kat mentioned in her introductory comments, a part of what makes tonight so special is really the opportunity for all of us to organize our efforts in a special and unique way. I think Frank really beautifully outlined the challenge that we're facing in glioblastoma multiforme, a particular type of intrinsic brain cancer. But one of the things that I'm fond of thinking about when we're introducing a subject is, why are we in a better position to answer a question today than we previously have been? Frank really elegantly demonstrated that the platform in terms of omics and the development of brain tumor avatars are allowing us now to actually think in terms of the fundamental biology of these tumors in a way that's very different than we have before. But when we take a step even farther back and think of stem cells beyond just being a therapeutic target, there's also a larger opportunity with stem cells in the brain, and that is taking what Catherine Canjo mentioned about this concept of neurorestoration and thinking about using stem cells as a biological payload that we can deliver to change the fundamental biology of the brain. And so what I hope to do in the next 10 minutes, as someone who actually has the opportunity to interact with the living brain every day, is to share with you some of the advances that have happened in the operating room that allow us to treat problems in a way that we didn't before. And I can tell you, as someone who's been trusted to lead a department, the greatest responsibility I have is to make sure that we learn as much as possible from every single time that we access the living brain. And so I'm deeply gratified to be in this ecosystem and to have the partners that I do, because you can actually see that we're not missing any shots on goal, to take Frank's vernacular. And so when we actually think about what happens in the operating room today at Jacobs Medical Center, what we do is we take that advanced connectomics to actually map very, very insulated tracts in the brain. If we're actually interfacing with a brain tumor, we're actually able, with very, very precise targeting, with submillimeter accuracy, to access a part of that tumor. You mentioned, Frank mentioned in his comments, that a tumor was sampled in 10 different locations. That's because that tumor is different in each of those 10 locations. And so the first step in building a spatial genomic atlas means that you need to know where that tissue came from precisely and be able to follow it in that patient over time. That's precisely the robust effort that we've undertaken over the last 2 years with the partnership of Dr. Kafouri Beaumont. That's allowed us to make sure that as we're actually following these patients over time, and we have a patient here tonight, we're making sure that we're actually identifying those parts of the tumor that represent the greatest risk to the patient, and being thoughtful and judicious about applying new technologies to treat that particular part of the tumor when the disease forces us to. And that allows us to benefit the patient that's in front of us, but also learn from each patient over time. When we actually take a step beyond just thinking about stem cells as a target for therapeutics, there's a larger opportunity to think about stem cells to exert a biologic effect. When I think about the brain, we've often actually been forced to think about the brain in terms of its structure alone, as a musical instrument as opposed to the music. You can actually see with advances in material science and advances in computational power, we're now able in a way that we couldn't before decode the actual music of the brain. So you actually see inset there on that white panel, a standard clinical EEG. That lower right image shows you the complex vectors taking place in one line of that EEG in terms of the cortical activity of the brain. In the upper inset picture, you actually see a speech and repetition task and all of the different parts of the brain that are recruited to exert that desired clinical effect. When you put all of this information together, you're able to actually identify abnormalities in different sorts of connectomes. And that's the first step I was sharing with Dr. Jacobs earlier. As a surgeon, you can't hit what you can't see. We are now in the process of seeing the connectomics of the brain in a way that's unique, and because of the advances that have actually taken place in the Jacobs School of Engineering, in a way that no one else can. And so that puts our surgeons in a position to think about manipulating those networks in a way that's new and different. That may help a stroke victim or someone with a spontaneous hemorrhage to rebuild these networks in a way that's different. It may mean that in a patient with intractable epilepsy, as one of my partners, Dr. Ben Heim, did, could actually inject for the first time inhibitory stem cells to break up those aberrant electrical networks. It puts us in a position to treat diseases in a whole new and different way, beyond just characterizing the biology of an individual tumor. This goes a step further in the operating room in using actually pre-commercial grids to actually merge all of this information together. Now at the point of care, you know, Kat is actually fond of invoking space as a way to move things forward. I can tell you, I feel like an astronaut in the operating room every day because there's a whole team of people in Houston that are putting me in a position to be successful. And now in real time, we actually have access to information that 5 years ago we didn't have. And so if you're actually planning a corridor through the brain to actually treat someone's disease, you don't want to know in a textbook where do these functional networks live. You want to know where is it in that particular patient so you can get there as safely as possible to deliver a therapeutic effect. And there are other diseases, actually, and work that's partly been pioneered by the Sanford Stem Cell Consortium that's really actually allowed us to already think about neurorestoration. When we look at patients with chronic spinal cord injury, my partner, Dr. Chachi, actually did some of the first and early stem cell trials to restore function to the spinal cord with the delivery of a stem cell payload. And when you actually think about stem cell delivery, the reason I raise the spinal cord injury model is because it shows us what's necessary and sufficient to advance. In order to actually deliver stem cells meaningfully as a therapeutic, you actually need the right biologic payload. You need an engineering solution like that floating cannula system that can actually get there in an atraumatic way. And you need to be able to follow that over time with imaging to make sure that you're exerting the desired biologic effect. And so those are the three principles that we're actually applying when we think about each of the disease states that we're going to be targeting as a center going forward. And then lastly, I'd be remiss to actually not emphasize, as someone who also focuses on the treatment of vascular disease, that open surgery and traversing the parenchyma is only one way to actually get things where they need to go. There's also going to be an opportunity with the advances in catheter-based treatments to deliver these stem cell therapeutics in a host of different ways. And so it's quite important when we think about the broader contribution that we're going to make that we're not limited to one set of skills. As we actually develop these disease states, as we actually better understand the biology with Frank's partnership, as we actually think about the best biologic payload and the network that we actually want to intervene on, we also have the means and the tools to get there in a way that other folks can't. And I can tell you that in the work that I do every day, it is very much a team sport. And as I think frankly, rightly framed for the audience, there's really not a region of the country right now that has a greater concentration of talent to solve these problems in a way that's unique and different. And if I've had any small measure of success, it's because I've had an eye for picking people who are stronger, faster, and better than me and blocking and tackling and getting out of their way. And so we're actually putting those teams together now. We're just starting to frame the right questions. It's outstanding to be here with all of you, and I think we're going to go out there and solve it together. So I couldn't be more excited for this brain tumor center and just excited for next steps. So hopefully that's a reasonable moose boosh. So thanks.
So we heard about talent, tenacity, teamwork, track record of getting extraordinary things done. We really wanted to have Anne O'Donnell just talk to us for a couple of minutes about what it's like to connect us. We've talked about philanthropy. We've talked about academic partnerships. What about industry? What about corporate relations? And what is it like to be a patient advocate in the midst of all this? So I'll have Anne O'Donnell come up. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I'm in my 23rd year of serving UC San Diego with corporate partnerships. It's been a thrill for me. I didn't plan on being a patient advocate at all. And in August of 2022, our collegiate athlete goaltender for the University of Utah Sun came home not feeling well. In fact, I was out with Tanner and Bill Nye, the science guy at the Data Science Institute, doing UC San Diego things, and I'll never have the same experience again when I got the call, you got to come home. And our son, Patrick, was just not behaving well. I mean, there's something was wrong. But as a goaltender mom, you say dehydration. Then you say he got hit in the head. So I'm calling all the people on the ice, did he get hit in the head? He had a seizure. So the decision was made, 911. It was the unknown with then the next hour of absolute unknown as we were escorted into a tacky waiting room at another hospital, and we just didn't know. We thought we'd lost him, but we didn't. But we didn't hear from him for 4 days as all the wires and tubes and such. And August 4th was the date we went to the hospital. August 10th, my husband's birthday, was the biopsy. August 19th, my birthday, was the diagnosis. That's a lot of time with a fast-growing, progressive, aggressive disease like glioblastoma. I had to Google it. I've had to Google things constantly. And then I think, well, people are working on this. I'm at UC San Diego. People are working. Google glioblastoma, UC San Diego. Frank Vernari. Hello, Frank. You know, and I'm just calling. And he was so encouraging. It's happening, but not quite yet. And then we wheel back to where do we go? And we heard Dr. Jessica Schulte is an expert on adolescent and young adult glioblastoma. That's perfect. Patrick is 20 years old. So not going back to school, not going to be a goaltender, not going back to be computer science. What do we do? So this, I'm just at a loss at this point. I'm Googling, calling, you know, just trying to find some groundswell. And then we meet Dr. Jessica Schulte, right, at Moritz Cancer Center, and she kept saying, we have options, and you need a team. Nobody told me you need a team. You need a quarterback, you need a surgeon, you need a radiologist, standard care, all these terms. Didn't know. Some of you have been through this. You know that this strategy is important. Well, until we met the team who have consistently buoyed our hope, the UC San Diego team, we always leave feeling, we got this. We've got options. And we went to other places. We traveled far. Patrick's tumors are diffuse, multifocal. He's got several of them. Nobody wants to take a child and young adult in a clinical trial. Thanks, Patty. who has multifocal, right? They want one tumor, zap it, done. We've proved our trial. So I've even, some of you know some of the AI programs out of Connect. There's a startup that will do, give me his entire genetic sequence. Okay, here, I'm big on data. I'll push it out. And an AI program showed all the clinical trials. There were 10. And thankfully, the faculty researchers at UC San Diego knew them. And this one's good, this one's not. And so I have felt in such good hands from day one. And I have called others. Patrick is under the care when he went back to school in January, by the way. Two A's. Just the fact, you know, when you read about this, there's dismal prognosis. There's all these terrible words. And finally someone said, stop reading. Okay, I will stop. And I listened to people like Dr. Colussi says, if that tumor acts up, I'm going in there and taking it out. And we walk out like Top Gun. Feel the need for speed. Okay, we just met the Maverick. And then Dr. Schulte with, we have options. We have lots of options. We're going to do something off-label. I said, does that mean I have to go behind the store and meet someone in the dark and do something? So I'm really learning. But yes, the corporate partnerships are going to be critical, and I'm ready. Because I do know the organizations, the nonprofits, and companies that rally around trying to accelerate. And, you know, I loved, we were together in a meeting, and one of the things you said, I love, I'm so good at this, I'm so good at this because I'm impatient. I said, that's good, because I'm like this, right? I'm like this. I'll meet somebody, I'll go to professional conferences, I want to know, when, can we, how do we accelerate this? And I can tell you, after building 9 Agile Centers of Excellence at UC San Diego, after building corporate partnerships, the corporate affiliates program at the Jacobs School of Engineering, I know this place can do amazing things. UC San Diego, because innovation happens at the intersections of disciplines. And I tell company this, there's no stovepipes. You bring us a problem, I'll fill the room with the experts. And they're all in different disciplines. And they get energy from knowing, and the chancellor talks about this all the time, we have to be impacting society. We have to be relevant. And every researcher operates on that. How can I be relevant? And so I'm very excited by this prospect of this center and really going in the hunt and building the kind of business models that business can, meaning the industry partners can come in, execute on, and deliver for patients, right? That's part of our job here, is pushing it out. So I'll stop there with the initial comments, and I'm just thrilled to have my son here in this world right now and here tonight, and I hope you all get a chance to talk to him later. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, so we've got movers and shakers here, and we've got Patrick. So Patrick, I think you have a few things to say. Would you like to come up here and tell us about your new video game that you're designing and your internship with Foundation Medicine and your hopes and dreams for the future, but what we can do to realize those dreams with you? So I'll let you take the mic just for a couple of minutes, and then we'll have a roundtable discussion. Thank you, Patrick.
Sorry. That was my lovely mother, Anne, Patrick. Most people just call me Patty. But I cannot commend enough my my doctors and my team. Dr. Colussi here, the absolute champion. You know. And those people have definitely inspired me to make a difference in this space, and you know, be a voice of hope for those people out there. You know, just stepping into this world like I was, you know, about 9-10 months ago. It's really been an honor to have such great people support me, and you know, my wonderful family and friends. I was, what I tell people is, you know, I feel like my job's, you know, a lot easier than, you know, my doctors. You know, I tell people I have the easy part. You know, the guys in the operating room are doing all the hard stuff, and you know, I just need to, you know, win the mental battleground. And I think that's been definitely a big docking point for me when I share my journey with people. Is the mental battleground is where you know, the patient makes the difference. And that's, you know, really the difficult part for most people is, you know, staying hopeful and, you know, looking out the rest of life and, you know, being positive. Because it's infectious, you know, and other people, they take from that. And, you know, I definitely think I've had a positive effect on others around me and my family.
Definitely have.
Oh, thanks.
So we're going to get you to sit right there, okay, if you like. So we're going to have Patrick, even though he likes to be called Patty, sit up here with us so he can answer more questions, because he's got some very interesting idea about making video games with nuns. I was very intrigued by this whole thing in Lourdes, France. But anyway, so I'd like to invite Dr. Kalesi up here, and then Naj Kafoury-Beaumont, because without the basic science, we're nowhere. And without real patient samples, again, we're not going to get very far. And then, Anne, if you can come back up. Sorry to keep putting you on the spot. So I wanted to go back to something that Alex talked about, saying we're the best. Because there are three large biotech companies, or hubs rather, in the U.S., Boston, San Francisco, and here. So why would we be the best in this field? Why would we be the first to do extraordinary things in the brain tumor field right here? Because we share our opinions, and they're all different, and they're all important. And we have key stakeholders in the audience who will make sure we get it right. Our 683 biotech companies who are meeting at Biocom this week are all hungry. They're younger. They're fresher, quite frankly. So I wanted to ask Dr. Kalesi a couple of questions, and I really want to open this up to the audience. So this incredible imaging capacity that you have now, how do we make that available more broadly? Clearly, you're at the forefront of the field. You run the Neurosurgical Society for the U.S. How do we make this more accessible to people who aren't as lucky as living in San Diego? What do you do with the rest of the country?
Yeah, so, well, I think the first step is actually to make sure, as I think as Frank touched on in his presentation, to understand the situation a particular patient's in. Because on day one, it's going to be challenging to actually concentrate the resources that are required to have the infrastructure to deliver care in the way that we're fortunate to do here in San Diego. And so the first step is recognizing that a patient's in that situation. We've actually developed, along with industry partners, a lot of post-processing software that actually makes sure that those connectomics are actually broadly available. What's less available is syncing that with your navigation, with the electrophysiologic data that we have now. And so as we actually develop those things, there's always obviously those early adopters and first movers, but then there is obviously that opportunity and responsibility really to scale to make sure that once we know the right thing to do in the care of a given patient, we're able to hit that mark every time. And so that's the journey we're on. That's a big part of our mission, obviously, as an academic institution. And I can just tell you, we're in a totally different place in the treatment of cranial cancer than we were a decade ago. It used to be that I wasn't quite maverick a decade ago because intrinsic brain tumors really weren't a surgical disease because it wasn't possible to actually remove those things with all of the adjuncts that we have now in a way that's safe and gets people back to their lives and gets them durable therapy and treatment well beyond the current median survival. And so I'm often fond of telling my own patients, while it's true the median survival is a point estimate, I can tell you that that spread is wide. And we're fortunate in San Diego to make sure that a lot of people end up on the right half of that curve. And that's because we're actually in a judicious way applying these different technologies.
So speaking of technologies, just one more question, and that's about AI and deep learning. We have Lee Stein here as a real leader in the area. Is that something that you anticipate being able to predict, prevent, and potentially reverse and get back to neural restoration for people that have had treatment successfully but are left with deficits?
Yeah, so I personally think about AI applications, and imaging is one of those areas where segmentation has been really, really helpful. As having two big applications in this space. The first is being able to abstract from large population-based data mm-hmm. to identify patterns that I think was embedded in Frank's presentation, how we actually saw that the biology of these different tumors is actually dividing in three primary categories that's clinically meaningful. So identifying those patterns at the population level will be one important application of AI over time. The second will be in an individual patient when we're actually segmenting and trying to fuse the imaging with that electrophysiologic data that we've shown. You can only match the computational power of the human brain with a little help, and AI is going to actually boost a lot of those post-processing algorithms to actually help us distinguish between noise and meaningful networks in the brain.
So speaking of networks, Patrick, you're developing a video game. And how could the video game that you're developing help us to understand or help patients to understand what they're going through? Is there a way to use the technology you're developing, do you think, to help us say, hey, this is your own journey and you can reign supreme like you have? What are your thoughts?
That actually is an interesting idea. I haven't previously thought about it. Like I said, was introduced. I talked to the nuns recently about making a video game for them. First time I thought of that.
And the nuns thought it was cool, right?
Yes. That actually is a very interesting idea. I'm beginning an internship at a Foundation Medicine Incorporated, and they do a lot of genomic sequencing. So I've recently thought about how I can incorporate the two, and especially education for sure, and bringing more light to the topic and educating younger people and how cancer works, and especially brain cancer is so much unknown. At least when I was getting into it and was initially diagnosed, there was so much I didn't know. Even as a biology student and a chemistry student going into college, it's just a lot of mysteries for me and my mother to discover. So I definitely think education is a big emphasis for me.
Well, we'll take you up on that offer. We may be putting you to work very soon. So I wanted to switch back to science a little bit with Dr. Kafoury Beaumont here. I'm not going to put Frank on the hook unless somebody has a very specific question, because it's always hard to do that remotely. You have another chance when we have a Closer Look seminar series, unless, Frank, you want to interject at some point. But so Dr. Kafoury Beaumont, Nash, as I like to call you, what's the importance of getting these primary patient samples for your science? What do you find that's so important about not modeling disease, but actually having the real thing in front of you?
That's a very good question. I sincerely believe that, there's a lot of factors that have stopped us from really finding a treatment for such terrible disease like GBM. And it is really finding a faithful model for the disease. We've tried many different models, but I think the one that's going to be the most faithful is really what's growing in the patient's brain. And having to really minimally try to alter anything in that tumor tissue is very important. So what we have been trying to do for the past 2 years with Dr. Kelesi's support is we tried the brain tissue bank in collaboration with the Moores Cancer Center, is we tried to get tissue from every patient that goes into the neurosurgery OR. And we do that very quickly. We can send patients, we have people ready. Within 2 minutes of ex vivo, the second the tissue comes out of the patient, it gets on ice or frozen, back to the lab for research, because we're trying to minimize the amount. It's away from the patient, so it really hasn't went through any modification, mechanical or a chemical or anything modification that could affect how is it really faithfully presenting to us what is happening in the patient's brain. So we really try to very clearly make sure that we are very thankful that the patients are willing to really give us their tissue to be able to provide some kind of research to try some treatment that could help, if not them, the patients that would be having GBM later on. And it's really very important to be really minimizing any form of any modifications of the tissue. So it's very important for us to get them directly from the patient into the lab and have it be processed as quickly as possible. And we try to grow the tissue from each patient so that they have their own cell lines that could try to sequence, we have some of the molecular profiling that comes from pathology, but we also try to look, at tumor mutations or mouse sectors that Dr. Bernard is interested in. And this is when we have the collaborations. We have, tissue that comes from breast cancer test that goes to your lab because you are the expert in doing this. And we have our work, which is Dr. Fernari touched on some of the risk factors. The lab is brain tumor epigenomics. I'm interested at the epigenetic level, as well as Dr. Beaumont, who is a faculty with Dr. Kelesi as well, neurosurgeon scientist who works on epigenetics as well in the lab. But my work really addresses one of those risk factors, which was that it's more prevalent in males compared to female. There's 1-6 ratio of more GBM happening in males compared to females, but also males do not respond to treatment as well as female. So as a female, even if you get GBM, you tend to have a survival advantage. So we're trying to understand what's really at the epigenetic level that makes male more at increased risk of getting GBM and not responding to treatment, whereas female have this resistance and really have a better response to treatment. So we're looking at a different set of targets epigenetically that really merges well with what Dr. Fernori is doing from the TERT. So it's like this collaborative, combinatorial kind of targeting of different targets in GBM that we are trying to put together in models that come immediately from the patients.
So speaking of immediately from patients, do you see a time where we could each have our own avatar as a patient, where you could, combine therapeutics in that one person? so we know what to develop for that one person. Is that something you see in the foreseeable future?
Yes, exactly. I think the tumor itself is very heterogeneous, even within the patient. So you have the intra and inter-heterogeneity. It is very important to try each patient as their own. And that's when we really talk about personalized neuro-oncology. I think it's going to have to be based on the patient. It's going to have to include what is the sex of the patient, what is its molecular profiling, what targets do we need to target, and getting those tissues and growing cell lines from each patient and looking at the molecular profiling is going to be very important at the patient level.
Thanks so much.
Sure, of course.
Two things that Naj said. The first is that a patient won't have a single avatar. They'll have multiple avatars reflecting the different cell populations in their tumor, and we'll be able, on the imaging, to follow the behavior and response to those avatars over time. So when you actually have thousands of patients that have actually participated in that kind of infrastructure, you'll know the decisive avatar to that patient's clinical outcome and be able to focus your treatment appropriately there. The other thing that I want to say for Naj that she won't say for herself is you asked, why us and why not somewhere else? The culture of what makes this place special is the reality of saying I'm available anytime the tissue is available is not a small thing. That's a 24/7, 365 job. And the team of people that have come together because they actually feel deeply invested in the mission and the fact that collecting that tissue and understanding what's required to process it adequately is important. I cannot overstate that as someone who's had an opportunity to practice a lot of leading institutions in the country. And the reason it's so fulfilling to do that is, Kat, in your introductory slide, you actually had work on ADAR that literally is a product of a tissue sample. We didn't give you that long ago.
That's right.
So the fact that you actually see that flywheel benefit so quickly really makes it clear that we have the right Destination Labs as partners.
Speaking of Destination Labs as partners, I'm going to give Anne the second to last word, and then we'll end with Patrick. Anne, how do we let people know we're here? Because I think the biggest problem with UC San Diego is nobody knows we're doing all this stuff and we're working so hard together. Yeah. We're the best kept secret. Well, we shouldn't be. How do we get the word out to our industry partners nationally and internationally? We're here, we're open for business, we want to work with them.
Yeah, it's that marvel of quiet competence, right? That we really enjoy with each other, this authenticity and passion that we all share in our domains. And one is calling it, like you said, we put a name on it, right? And going out to your technical conferences and really talking about it. And they already know the reputation of UC San Diego. And I love the flywheel. That's one of my favorite models for getting things going. And we have all the right ingredients. And as soon as we get out to, we were talking just earlier about different domains and different device companies are going to think about it one way. Pharma will think about it another way. So who are the best partners and what will we offer them? We will offer them a chance to come in and partner with us and meet patients and hear stories. And we've done this well so many times. I'm really excited. Personally, I'm excited, of course, because it doesn't exist anywhere in this way. And we've been other places, right? So we know. I just think it has its own magic to it, frankly, and passion. And there's a selflessness about the researchers I've worked with across the board at UC San Diego wanting to impact society, and in particular, that in patients to deliver for patients. I'm excited for the future.
Yeah.
The fact that Patty's here, there's a lot we could go through with, as Dr. Kalesi said, Patty doesn't give us much notice. Four unplanned surgeries, nope, not much notice. And just, your responses are always, it's my pleasure, but it's also my responsibility. And this sense of ethics that comes across and, I've never felt, we're all in for the science. Patty, you said before, well, if it improves, somebody else's situation, I'm all for it. I don't want anybody's sugar pills. That was clear from the beginning. I'm not doing placebos or sugar pills. Let's go.
So on the last note, Patrick, let's go. Where do you want us to go in the next 6 months, the next year, the next 5, 10? What are your main goals for us?
I definitely think the emphasis on education and then accessibility as well. So, there's a lot of, questions and confusion, when people are first diagnosed. And there's not really like a, oh, I know this place that will help. Oh, sorry. it's not really, a guidebook for like how people do this and, how, you find care and the right care for you. And, a lot of the times patients will find themselves running across the country, all these different hospitals and different specialists and, like which one's the best, what's right for me. And so I think having something like this would be a great center for people to just, oh, I can come here and, get a great opinion or, the best opinion hopefully would be the goal. Right. Having options in education is just, I think, the biggest emphasis for me personally. As somebody who, went through the whole process of confusion and, trying to figure out where the right place is and, the right, what's the right medicine care for me. So I definitely think just guidance and education, pointing people in the right direction and then getting them cared for.
So you've heard from the champions, and those are my burning questions. Does anybody in the audience have a question, or would you like to wait till the mingling? Anybody have a burning question that you'd like to ask one of our experts here on the panel? Bill Hagee.
I've had experience like you have, you're suddenly in this whole world, luckily at 1 a.m. or midnight or so, I called Sheldon Katrina. Went to the hospital, I thought it was a stroke. I think, and then I talked to another friend of mine who's a very good doctor, and he said, talk to as many people as possible. So I talked to people at Duke University, at Harvard, et cetera, all across the country. And it, like you were just saying, that's what you do. Maybe one way to get publicity to what you're doing is to take that. Oh, we are the people to talk to who know all of this stuff who can help you.
There you go.
Figure out where to go. Don't waste your time going to Dana-Farber. They're working with the rhinovirus or whatever, and that's not working. I don't mean to be too blunt, but people need real answers. They need them now. That's part of the thing. You can't just say, you can't be overly polite. Mm-hmm. Perhaps there's an opportunity. That's my goal.
And at the back of the room, thank you, Bill.
I just have a quick question. I met the you and I are friends. That's Patrick's father, Eddie's father. And I went through the UCSD experience, unfortunately, with my brother like 6 years ago. So the first comment I want to make is it's stunning how far this has come in just that period of time. And I want to put a shout out to Dr. Picayune.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
He's a sweet tart problem, but he's still great.
He's our neurosurgical oncologist, or neuro-oncologist par excellence, just so you know.
I think what I'm hearing and what I experienced, and I felt compelled, like I didn't really know Annie, and I had just an association with Huey. But when you hear this and somebody's going through it, you've been through it, you can't keep your mouth shut. You're so empathetic to what they need. And so my question is, is there a case manager assigned to this trick bag that somehow is the first point of contact? Like, hey, I'm here to take you through your journey, because, I mean, the doctors, like you said, if a new pathology walks in the door today, we're all on it, right? It's like, somebody with the passion Manny's got, and, that's more the administrative side. Is there a patient advocate?
Well, we will definitely have a navigator once this becomes a center. Right now we're launching the program, but it looks like it's becoming a center very quickly, Dr. Klesy. So we will be able to apply resources once we grow it, but it may be very, very quick, Anne. Very quick. Sense of urgency. Oh, we're all impatient. And as Bill said, you cannot wait. Yeah. You know, that's a luxury that your loved one can't afford. You cannot wait. So we have to get this done. So we will definitely have a patient navigation program, but we've got resources. So we've got a breadth of talent here, too much energy to know what to do with. And that's just Patrick. So I wanted to thank everyone for participating in this and for your leadership, Dr. Klesy, and for Frank Fornari, you'll hear from both of them, and to T. Denny Sanford for helping us really expand the universe of possibilities for people who really need them. So thank you for being here and for joining us today. So we'll have refreshments outside. Thanks again.